Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live webinar. Make sure you subscribe to the show and rate us on YouTube and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. And I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by John Johnson, Head of Capital Formation at Pantera Capital, a $5.6 billion digital asset manager founded by Dan Moorhead that specializes in crypto investments. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
Yeah, we're excited to get going here. I thought maybe to start off, you could walk everyone through a little bit around your background and how you sort of got into a crypto-focused firm and Pantera specifically.
Yeah, no, thank you. So I think the path to Pantera was interesting. I'm the same age as the founder, and we both had careers before that. I had worked in Silicon Valley from 1997 through 2011. I designed databases at Cisco. I was working at Systems. But then also got into process improvement in the networking space, and then did a startup that was funded by Excel called IOSpan Wireless, and then went as a to a VC firm doing healthcare investing. And then my last two roles before Pantera were for family offices. One, the co-founder of eBay, a gentleman named Jeff Skoll, who had started eBay back in 1995 with Pierre Omidyar. And I was the CEO of his family office for 9 years in Palo Alto in New York. And, Jeff was a very innovative guy with eBay. And we did asset allocation, manager selection, and a lot of direct investing at a place called Capricorn, which was the name of that family office, and got to invest early on in Tesla, SpaceX, Vitamin Water, a lot of cool things through our network. And then I joined a gentleman named Jeff Keswin, who was a co-founder of Greenlight Capital with David Einhorn. And Jeff's family office was called Lyrical Partners. Helped him with his venture investing, did a lot of technology software investing, and also built some asset management businesses on his platform. I met Dan Moorhead, the founder of Pantera. We lived in the same town in California. And he had, I met him about 3 years ago through a common friend. And he's a very dynamic guy. And I'd heard about him and I'd heard about Pantera. At the same time I met him, I was working with an analyst at the Lyrical family office, Stanford grad who was really into Bitcoin and blockchain. So he had really studied it for a long time, had made some Bitcoin investments, and he had gotten me up the curve. So by the time I met Dan, I knew a bit about blockchain and Bitcoin and the value proposition. And then so Dan and I spoke frequently. I started reading his letters, and about a year and a half ago, he was saying the firm is really growing, and I had a network of family office contacts. And so We talked about me joining to help scale the firm and grow the asset base. And I've sat on a university endowment board for 12 years as well. So I kind of knew that side of the business. But it's been a great ride for the last year, for sure.
Well, that's exciting. And, I think Pantera is fairly well known as one of the top managers, in the digital asset space. But maybe we could walk everyone through a little bit more around Pantera and certainly the growth of the last couple of years.
Yeah. Dan, the founder, it's really the story of Dan's vision for what he saw. He came from a space that was, he was a Princeton civil engineer, won the Carmichael Prize. He was the first asset-backed securities trader at Goldman, then was hired by Julian Robertson at Tiger Management to head macro trading. So that informs his view of blockchain, because as he looked for big asymmetrical trades in the world, and big macro trades, he looked at things that would really be transformative over time. And so, he did that for Julian for a while and really cut his teeth on what those would look like, whether it was like Russian privatization, Argentine farmland, you name it. Those are the big macro trades that he looked at on behalf of Tiger. But then he started Pantera actually in 2003 as a macro hedge fund and ran about $1 billion in institutional capital. And around 2011, 2012, Pete Brigger, his friend running Fortress, said, "Dan, I love the way your mind works. You look at macro trades. You know technology. There's this new thing called Bitcoin. I'd love to talk to you about it." And so Dan spent some time with Pete, spent some time with some other kind of now luminaries in the space like Wences Cesaris, the founder of Zappo. And Dan did a deep dive for, I don't know, 6 to 8 months, and then said, look, this is the most transformative technology that I've seen in my career. And from an investment perspective, really an asymmetrical trade opportunity, like low downside, because it was very cheap back then, but big upside if it really was going to come to fruition. And so, you know, fast forward to now, Dan started then 2013, really the next iteration of Pantera, which is, by the way, not named after the heavy metal band. People ask that all the time. You know, Pantera is Italian and Spanish for panther, and it's Dan being a tiger cub. That's where that came from. It also means, you know, across eras, you know, pan era, and then Pantera across the earth. So it's like big, you know, big ideas is what informs that name. But in 2013, he started investing only in blockchain and crypto. So first venture fund to do equity investments in blockchain related technologies like exchanges and exchange technologies. And then did the first Bitcoin fund in the US, which is the first cryptocurrency fund, the Pantera Bitcoin Fund, which still exists after 9 years. It's done, you know, I think it's up about 65,000% from inception. So those two are the first two of their kind. And then fast forward to now, we have 57 people. Dan and the team with co-CIO Joey Krug have done two more venture funds, so a total of three. The Bitcoin fund still exists after 9 years. In 2017, he added a liquid token fund, which is a portfolio of widely traded tokens. You know, some of the usual suspects like Ethereum, Bitcoin, of course, Arweave, Uniswap. There's a number in there, usually it's about 15 at a time. And then the early stage token fund, which is also started in 2017, which is designed to find teams of developers that are coming up with the new tokens and coins that will be equally transformative. That's more like a venture style on the token space. So so I'll stop there for a minute, Peter.
No, it's really impressive. And, you know, I know I want to spend a little time on Joey too, because I feel like, you know, a lot of people talk about Dan, but I know Joey is being, you know, really influential mind there at Pantera. So maybe you could walk everyone through Joey's background.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if there are 10 people in the world that know more about DeFi than Joey. You know, he was a Thiel Fellow, was at Pomona College. He wrote the first application on Ethereum. It's called Augur, A-U-G-U-R. And Joey's been involved in like 5 of the top 100 application projects on Ethereum. He really knows how it works, how flexible it is. You know, Ethereum's like a multi-purpose blockchain. It's very different from Bitcoin. It's very flexible, very secure. And these applications that can be built on top of it either speed it up or allow it to be used for smart contracts. Joey really knows a ton about the programming involved, smart contracts, and then this concept of decentralized finance, which is a major theme of Pantera's. You know, you've got centralized finance, which is how the world works now, and centralized, you know, exchanges moving to a decentralized where there's no real central organization. The system runs itself if designed properly. So that DeFi, we feel, is going to be incredibly transformative as, you know, the guts of the financial system is reinvented to be lower cost, easier, more accessible to people, and in the end, safer. So that's a huge area for us. And Joey really is he's a computer scientist through and through. He's got an amazing ability to look at the ecosystem of blockchain and cryptocurrencies and see what fits, see what's needed. Whether, you know, you talk about layer one blockchains, which are their own blockchains, and then layer two, which are applications built on top of that. So Joey's got an amazing network. Just a real sharp mind about seeing around corners and over the horizon about what's coming next.
And you know, you kind of alluded to some of this, but I know Pantera kind of has a thesis about the world, especially around, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain. Maybe you can sort of share with everyone what that thesis is and what that really, or how you expect maybe that to play out over the course of the next 3, 5, 10 years.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I think the idea is that we will see an enormous change in how the finance system works. This is not going to happen overnight. There's reasons why it's structured the way it is. There's checks and balances, there's safety, there's, you know, regulations that protect investors and make sure people pay taxes. But, you know, over time, I think we feel like blockchain technologies will allow the last thing the internet didn't really handle, which is, you know, when the internet was, you know, it started in the 70s technically, right, with ARPANET and such, but, you know, in the late 90s when the internet started to commercialize, the treatment of information and the access to information really exploded, right? At first you had static websites, and then you had interactive websites, and eventually you got visibility. You could apply for a mortgage online, you could look at your bank statement online, and then we all have these magic devices right in our hands. So not only computers and laptops, but phones allowed access to information. The one thing it didn't really affect was the underlying guts of the financial system. It still takes, you know, 3 days to send a wire to London, and, you know, $45. It takes a long time to fill out a mortgage application. You have to do it by hand often. You can do it on the internet. You have to do property insurance for the same property 10 times in a row. It's just, there's no real system that's SWIFT system. SWFT was supposed to like make it faster to move money around. It made it faster relative to 1950, but not relative to now. It's so this antiquated guts of the system. We have more visibility into it, but we feel like blockchain, decentralized finance will make those changes. So we're there to enable that. And that's one area that we look at. The other area is just, you know, allowing people to borrow, lend, transmit money in ways that are, you know, more efficient, cheaper, faster. And when you think about it, you know, 3.5 billion people in the world have an iPhone. Not all of those people, not even close to all of those people, have access to good currencies, good systems, or even a bank. And so there's a democratization of financial possibility that we feel is really going to change. And for the good of a lot of people, it'll be transformative. And again, make it more egalitarian, how people access, you know, wealth creation in a nutshell.
And so, you know, with all these potential use cases and really important potential for, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain, I'm curious, you know, how do you all kind of, you know, square away some really prominent historical investment figures like a Warren Buffett of the world or some others that have really been resistant to this change and have been fairly negative on the movement? How do you all kind of like, you know, square all that away with your views of the world?
Yeah, you know, look, if somebody like Warren Buffett is so well respected, he has done very well for his investors over time by studying the basics. And I think that works for him. And that's wonderful. We don't have any issue with that. We feel like there's disruptive technologies that are just uncomfortable for people. You know, you've heard the term perhaps called, it's a trustless way. You know, Bitcoin and blockchain are trustless. That doesn't mean there's no trust. It means there's no need for trust because the system works in a way with checks and balances that are more automatic. So I think it's just going to take some time and proof points for people to realize, yes, you can send money. It's going to get there. You know, the Bitcoin blockchain has operated since 2009 without issue. It's been up 24/7, 365 with zero compromise. I mean, exchanges have been hacked. Yes, people's iPhones, but the blockchain itself has worked perfectly. I don't know if there's a time in history where basically a distributed or any kind of database can have that track record. So are there cash flows? People say, oh, there's no cash flows to Bitcoin or some of these other things, so I can't trade it. Well, there's no cash flows to the euro dollar transaction, but people trade that all the time. There's a I think a feeling of you have to, they call willing suspension of disbelief. Stay open and study what this is. It's not the easiest thing to study. There's certainly ways to study it, but it takes a bit of a leap of faith at first because we like control. Control has worked. It's developed a lot for the world. But to give up control to a software system that actually works really, really well is just a leap of faith. And so, and look, like anything else, there is the opportunity for people to lose money, or like any industry, there's a place for people to, you know, less inclined people to follow the rules will get in somewhere. So it's good to protect against that, but that doesn't mean that the underlying technology and its promise should be ignored. So we're just going to keep, you know, investing in things that we think are going to, you know, add value and be secure. and answer solutions in a way that, again, makes things cheaper, easier, more fairer, and more distributed.
So maybe quickly, you know, just to educate everyone, you know, there's a lot of different components, and I think a lot of terminology that gets thrown out when discussing digital assets. Things like layers, protocols, and even the difference between a coin and a token. Yeah. So maybe you could spend just a couple of seconds just kind of helping to provide some foundational understanding for, you know, how to kind of understand and kind of think about all these different terms.
Sure. No, it's a great question. And one thing I'll just say on the whole issue, when I told you guys I worked for Jeff Skoll, who's a wonderful guy and super innovative with eBay. He wrote the first business plan for eBay. And I remember talking to him once when I was working for him, and I said, what were the biggest challenges? And he said, well, back in like 1997, people would laugh at him and saying, you're going to put your credit card on the internet and you're going to expect someone to send you something and not steal your credit card information. And he used to say, like, you got to trust that 99.5% of people will do the right thing. And eventually trust develops when people see that it works. And I remember that always rings true for me as I was studying blockchain, that these disruptive technologies do require a sense of trust until you realize how it works. And he had gone through that phase himself, as maybe some people on the call here remember from the internet days. But so back to the terms, Peter. So, you know, people talk about blockchains layer one. And all that means is it's a foundational blockchain, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Polkadot, Solana, Cosmos, or some of the new ones. And when people talk about a coin, a coin by definition has its own layer one blockchain, its own blockchain. Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum has a coin called ETH. That layer one, a token is, those are digital currencies that run on another blockchain. So technically speaking, you know, Bitcoin's not a token and Ethereum's not a token. A Sol on Solana is not a token there. Those are coins, but anything else that runs on top of that is considered a token, which is fine. There's an ecosystem that develops. It's, you know, like a remora and a shark, you know, whatever mutualistic cliche you can come up with, it works that way. But a layer one blockchain is, again, its own blockchain. They talk about layer two blockchains, and those are called applications that work with the original blockchain, the foundational blockchain, but make it faster or help communicate data to another blockchain, or allow for, some other lending or an exchange to occur that works with the core blockchains are really awesome, foundational, functional machines. And these applications can work with that as they should, right? As the ecosystem develops. One other way of looking at it, and there's a chart that I can maybe share with you all later, that in the original, when the internet was developed, think about the protocols were like SMTP or HTML. These were the SMTP is email, right? A lot of these protocols, and even the basic protocol, Tim Berners-Lee and Vint Cerf inventing the internet effectively, were they didn't get any money for that. It was the applications on top of. It was like, you know, Facebook and everything else, these applications that use those foundational protocols, but you couldn't make money by investing in SMTP. How would you have done that? But with, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, these are layer one. These are the protocols, and you can invest in those. They're now investable. And yes, the applications on top of that will also make money, but it's more balanced between the two. So that's the last thing I'll say on the coin versus token and the layer one and layer two. But there are these things. It'll be like the Buddhist hierarchy. There's foundational values, and then there's things you learn over time and can be built on top of those foundations.
No, that's honestly, we've had quite a few different, crypto focused folks, DeFi included, that have come on, and I think that might be one of the most articulate explanations we've had. So appreciate that. You did kind of mention earlier when you're talking about all the things that Pantera does, and as I mentioned, you know, roughly about $5.6 billion in assets as of December. And I think, you know, a lot of what you do is structured based on, the different life stages or life cycles of different tokens and coins. So maybe, you know, you could, without necessarily talking about the strategies themselves, you can just talk about the life cycles of, you know, a new token coming on and sort of how those come to be. And maybe, also some of the things then that when you are thinking about some of those, new technologies and protocols, what you look for that really gets you guys excited?
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. So, tokens in the end and coins are, it's programming, right? There's Solidity and some other programming languages. And to invent your own coin or token is awesome. I mean, the idea, it's happening all the time. The talent pouring into the space is great. But, you know, you need to be a computer programmer and you need to understand how that works. There's developer platforms like Alchemy, which is one of our venture investments. It's actually, you don't even need a token, ironically, to get into Alchemy. They get paid in dollars. You purchase their software. They're kind of like the Amazon Web Services of blockchain, Alchemy. And they just got valued at over $10 billion. We've been an investor for about 4 years. And they provide the software for starting decentralized applications and tokens. So you have to decide, what's your blockchain architecture? What's your, they call consensus mechanism. People have talked about proof of work, which is, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum to this point, and everything else is proof of stake, meaning you have to show ownership of tokens before you can use that that token or earn other tokens. So the developing that, there's software and there's software available to develop those tokens. The things that we look for in that process, which is not simple, it's hard to do. And that's why having a lot of technical talent on the team, you know, Joey, I already talked about his background. We have William Fan, he's from Caltech. Lawrence Defiant has a computer degree, CS degree from Columbia. She used to design exchanges. There's a lot of technical capability on the team. And that provides two benefits. One, it allows us to see which developers are talented and who's going to actually probably do what they will be able to do what they say they're going to do. And then once we've made that investment, the entrepreneurs and the developers really love working with Pantera because we can solve technical problems. We can help them hire. We can help them with strategy. And the reason we have 85% of our deals on the illiquid side, so early stage tokens, and even venture come to us is because of that reputation. I'd love to say I'm part of that. I'm not part of that of the team, but I do know of that team, and the entrepreneurs really respect and love the fact that we get on really early in, especially on the early stage token side. We love to partner with those people because, you know, I think that's one of our competitive advantages we'd like to think is that technical capability allows us to see what are they trying to build. Does the ecosystem need it? Who are the competitors? Are they going to be able to do what they say they're going to do? Are they going to do it in enough time? Are they going to do it efficiently? And so that's why we get early on. We're not like a growth stage firm. We could probably get into that, but I think what's really worked over 9 years is getting in early. But again, it's computer programming. There's a lot of talented programmers that are, you know, learning blockchain and cryptocurrency programming languages. But again, you have to understand, is that going to work? I'll give you one example. It's self-serving, but, you know, 5 years ago, Paul Virata-Tockett, who runs part of the early stage token investing and venture with Joey and Dan, found these guys from Polkadot. And they said, we're going to enable blockchains to communicate and share data. And at the time, that was kind of science fiction, because as I mentioned, well, a layer one blockchain can have an application and work with that. To allow core blockchains to communicate was really a little bit hard to imagine. And then they also, Polkadot was saying, we can have a very scalable blockchain. And they made both of those happen. It took like 4 years, but, you know, that's been a crazy good investment for the investing team at Pantera. And it really came down to identifying the team that we recognize would be able to do it.
And so, you know, in that scenario, right, these are tokens that have not, more often than not at this early stage, these are tokens that have not gone through their ICO, so their initial coin offering. And effectively, you know, as I understand it from what you're saying, there's kind of two ways you can play it. Certainly, you can take a true venture approach and try to get actual equity in the underlying, you know, team's business. Or perhaps, you know, there's also opportunities to maybe get, tokens in terms of your contribution to the project. Maybe you'll walk everyone through that.
Yeah, no, it's another great question. So we look at early stage tokens as kind of like venture. And I'm sure a number of folks have been on the call here, know enough about venture to know it takes time and money and talent recognition and business case recognition. So the team will work with the developer team creating the token, giving them technical advice, trying to make it as efficient as possible. And then over time, that just they grow it. They get people to start using the token. Does it work with other applications? Does it work with layer one blockchains? Is it work efficiently? Does it require more energy, or I should say, more? Is there more friction in the use of it? And we look at, we say, on-chain data and off-chain data. So even things before their ICO, people start using the token, they test it, they have developers testing it in beta environments. And those early stage developers, when they're developing the token, you can see what is drawing value. And yes, there's an ICO process per se. It's very different from like an IPO process, but you can see when other developers are saying, yeah, this token works, I can use that token to solve this problem. They can, they find that value comes in. And then this off-chain data, they look at social media and Discord, and they look at other applications that are being developed. And if none of them work as well as the core, they can make adjustments to the early stage token project. They can, a lot of it's hearsay, but with other programmers. We have a great network. That's one other thing that Paul, Dan, and Joey and the team have developed, is a great network of people who can provide feedback on whether a certain application or even a new layer one blockchain is working. So it's constant iteration. It's getting feedback from, the numbers that are working as the system is drawing more value and users. You can have users in a token environment before it's widely traded. So there's this ecosystem that develops before something you see on Kraken or Coinbase. People can see how well it works and what's not. And then eventually there are enough tokens released to exchanges that can draw more value. So I hope that answers the question.
Oh, very much so. I'm kind of curious, you've spoken so much about partnering with these teams, that are working on these, new protocols and technologies. We've often heard that, VCs are kind of shut out of the crypto community. And I know Pantera is kind of not exactly a VC, but I'm kind of curious how, that all works and how Pantera kind of is able to partner with these folks who more often than not, tend to kind of reject that style of traditional investments.
So I think, as a former, as a person that used to work in a venture capital firm, which was, was healthcare related, really loved it. Entrepreneurs feel, I think there's always a tension between who has control of the company, how much money is being used, how efficient. It works. I mean, these amazing companies have been built, but I think that, and that still works. We invest in venture investments, and other great firms do if they're blockchain oriented or maybe less blockchain oriented. But for the early stage token and developer teams, you're just getting tokens for you're giving out tokens for getting money from an investor like Pantera. That's different. I mean, the rules are very different about a token, whether it's a governance token or what does that token confer? It's very different from, we have preferred equity, or we have common equity, and we have, liquidity preference and ratchet provisions. And, having written a lot of those term sheets, I know that can be bewildering to an entrepreneur, and it's a very emotional decision. But with the tokens, it's just kind of the tokens. And so it's much simpler, where they're like, look, you like this project, you're going to assume that the token will accrue value over time. And, again, the type of token, there's a governance token, which gives you decision making over time. And there's a curve to, as tokens get released, there's first kind of centralized control, and then that's certainly loosened up as more and more people own it, with the idea being it's decentralized and there's shared ownership by everyone with the token. So it's considered more democratic in a lot of cases, without all the I guess, the all the moving parts of a normal venture investment. So I think they people like you either like our token or you don't. It's the control issues seem to be fair, or at least seen as fair by some of these developer teams. But in the end, I mean, we try to be really good to work with and super supportive. And so that's that we try to do that on the venture side as well as the early stage token side. But I know that entrepreneurs, if they have a choice, they like to find a firm who really understands, you know, token, blockchain, crypto investing, and the ecosystem. So I know it's not an aversion to venture capitalists, many of whom are awesome and smart. It's just an aversion to, it's a love of the firms that can add value early on. And if you, there's not that many. I mean, fortunately, Pantera is one of them, but we're very respectful of some of the other great firms in our space, but there's just not many of us. So we like the fact that people will come to us and, Dan, when he founded the firm, was just a visionary and, you know, hired Joey and Paul fairly soon after that. And so I think they've developed a reputation to be easy to work with and also just tons of expertise that if a early stage token developer team needs help early on, they'll get it. And I interviewed a developer before I started at Pantera just to kind of get a lay of the land. And they're like, we know that the Pantera guys show up every week. They're on calls. They help us. And they know they can't get that from someone who doesn't have as much expertise.
Very interesting. And, you know, we've talked a lot about these tokens and, you know, it's kind of hard to, kind of understand if it's a finite universe or kind of really, you know, there could be a use case for hundreds of tokens in over the long term. So what kind of is the end game, right? Like, you know, if you look out 5-10 years from now, certainly, you know, the number of layer one, opportunities might not be significantly larger than they are now. But how do you sort of think about those layer two, tokens that could kind of exist and how many do you think kind of end up, you know, really being, I don't know the right term, mainstream, if you will, you know, 10, 15 years from now, or is it just end up being where there's only five because the five best ones eventually emerge?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because people say, well, what's going to win? Is Bitcoin to be the new currency, the new dollar, or is it Ethereum? You know, that's kind of the wrong question. We think in the end, there'll probably be about 10 to 15 core tokens and coins. I'll call them all tokens just for ease of description. But so we think there'll be like 10 to 15 core use cases that will make up the ecosystem of the blockchain and crypto universe. And when I say a lot of that's going to be, it's not just going to be decentralized finance, you know, it's going to be commerce, it's going to be any kind of record keeping, medical records, real estate, but these will all work in concert. And there will be a consolidation where some applications will merge into other blockchains. That will happen eventually. But I think right now you're going to have Bitcoin, great store of value, right? But it's not a great currency. Ethereum is a very it's like programmable Bitcoin. When it first came out in 2015, Joey and I spoke once and he's like, anytime you have something that becomes programmable, it just opens up a whole nother universe. So that's going to continue, but we think there'll be like, you know, Bitcoin, we don't see it going anywhere. Ethereum, we like Solana because it's very, very fast and it's easy to work with. But Ethereum is like super secure, incredibly flexible. It's kind of like, I'm not sure if I said this before, this like a protein and an enzyme. There's like really good proteins and enzymes that work together. If you know how that works a little bit in healthcare, that they just, they mesh really well. And so, but there'll be things that make blockchains faster, things that allow data transfer and data sharing, things that are aggregators. You're going to have there's one called OneInch, which is it's like a Netflix for all decentralized finance. Like, do you want to go to Maker and Aave and Compound and look for the right staking, you know, interest rate that you can get from staking your assets? No, you want to go to one place that's kind of the one-stop shop, the Amazon, you know, that we all have on our phones to buy stuff. You want to go one place, and OneInch is that. And so these consolidators will be one day like an Amazon shopping place for how you can get, you know, can lend and borrow. So we do think it won't be thousands. It won't even be hundreds. We think by 20 years from now, it'll be like, you know, these 10 to 15 use cases that will be kind of the winners. And then a lot of the ecosystem will evolve where it, you know, kind of comes together where applications get, you know, programmed into some of these blockchains. But part of the beauty of the system is that there needs to be multiple players in this. You know, you look at the US economy, there's not one bank, there's many. There's not one place to shop, there's many. But there's not, there's always a homeostasis that's reached. And I think we think it'll be 10 to 15 tokens. One area that I'll mention, and it's kind of the evolution here, that, you know, we look at gaming, and I'll try to explain why we think this consolidation evolution will happen. We've all heard about NFTs. We don't invest in NFTs, but you're damn sure we're investing in companies that allow creation and trading of NFTs, like Maker's Place is an old investment of ours. I say old, it's like, you know, three years old. It's old in crypto world. I was telling someone that Paul and Dan and Joey have worked together for 7 years, which is like, you know, the Paleolithic period in crypto, right? So over time, NFTs allow for unique identification of digital assets. Okay, that's great. But then you have this case where certain technologies will allow blockchains to operate faster, because, you know, Bitcoin's only like 7 transactions per second. Ethereum's like double that. And so you have to have a system that runs faster. And there are what they call scalability solutions. So there's scalability solutions, there's NFTs, and then there's this concept of being able to share data between blockchains. And what's that? Why is that interesting? Well, we see that the world of gaming is really what's allowing NFTs to become so popular. And yes, we have art and, you know, CyanCat and some of these people things selling for a lot, and that's all great. But when you go into a game right now, you can't port value from one game or digital assets from one game to another until you get into blockchain-based games where they can now have a common kind of meta language of communication. So if you have identification of digital assets, the ability for blockchains to communicate, and faster systems, you now allow games, people can take asset, they can earn currency, Solana, Ethereum, others that, you know, the game is based on one token or another. They can earn it there, then they can port it to another game, which is kind of amazing. And they can take their digital asset and they can take the money they've earned in one game and go to another. Is that cool by itself? Absolutely. The implications for retail are unheard of. Like, you think about the ability to have different shopping platforms where you can move digitally tracked assets and different tokens that allow to confer porting value, but then using that those currencies elsewhere is going to totally remake, you know, commerce as kind of we know it. So that story is meant to describe how we try to stay open-minded about the ways, like a good stem cell, you know, it's trying to give you a sense of the possibility of what's going to evolve. And then we try to stay open-minded. You know, we're not experts at everything, right? We try to see ahead, but part of that is to stay open-minded about what's coming around the curve. And what's great about having a lot of deal flow on the early stage token side is that we see so many talented people, and they're like, what if we could do this? And the ideas that are coming out of that world right now are great. And we're just lucky to be kind of one of the first stops for them to propose their idea.
That's great. You kind of mentioned at the front end, you know, I think your original Bitcoin funder, Pantera's, I think you said an astonishing number, like 65,000% return since 2013 or so when it launched. You know, I think the early stage token fund that you all have as well, you know, has done exceptionally well. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, knowing that type of performance, and I think, you know, it's over 1,000% for the early stage token fund. How do you all think about risks and whether or not, you know, a lot of that performance has been achieved is kind of sustainable going forward? Or maybe it's just more about the market too in general.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, like I want to say the early stage token fund just last calendar year was up 295%. And so that was a great year. There were dark days. You know, the first year it was existing in 2017, terrible. 2018, flat, basically. There'll be periods where it goes up as people recognize that the government's not going to outlaw tokens and that these tokens actually work, the systems work. So how do we is two questions, like how sustainable are those returns going forward? We feel like the opportunity set over the next 5 to 10 to 20 years is so enormous. Like you're thinking about reinventing even the 128 trillion the last time I saw in the bonds in the world, 128 trillion. There's only like 400 billion in DeFi right now. I mean, it's got this kind of huge opportunity set to be remade. So are we going to have 300% returns every year? No, but the opportunity set over 10 years or 5 years, it's as finance gets remade and blockchain is more trusted, we feel is we're very early innings on that. So the way we try to do great due diligence to risk manage on the teams as they develop the token, is that token going to be needed? We have an eye towards, you know, the regulatory environment in the United States. You know, obviously, if the government can tax profits, that's great. If the SEC can protect investors, that's great. And we see slowly but surely the government's getting smart about how they're understanding more about Bitcoin and blockchain. And, you know, Gary Gensler taught a class at MIT on Bitcoin. He knows the space. He also has a job to protect investors. So it'll slow things down a little bit. But we feel like any token we come up with, it's only going to crystallize. Regulation will confirm that the United States will be a great place to develop these tokens. But in terms of the returns over time, we try to keep like, you know, 30 to 35, sometimes more early stage tokens in the system to diversify so that, you know, it's not like the venture model where one out of 10 will be 100x return and you'll make the fund back. We try to make most way more than half of our tokens through early due diligence and management of the teams to be, you know, big winners as this, you know, as the system evolves over time. But, you know, I think the early stage token fund, it's riskier because they're early stage by definition, but, you know, the returns, like you said, I think it's up 12x in 5 years. And we feel like we're in, because in the early innings over this, it's hard to predict what each year is going to do, but the talent we see coming into the space is great. There is an egalitarian sense of, you know, the money coming into the space is great as well, but there is limits to your earlier point, Peter, how many people can look at these early stage deals? Not many really understand them. Venture is easier to understand. It's not easy, but it's easier. The early stage token stuff requires some expertise. And so that by itself, we think is a bit of a risk management perspective, because we and just several others, I think, are the only ones who understand which early stage tokens will be, I think, successful.
That's great. You know, John, I think we're about at time here. You know, I do want to remind all of our listeners, you know, certainly keep their eye out. You know, YieldTreat is launching its first crypto focused fund here in the coming, hopefully this evening. And it will feature a strategy of Pantera's. So we hope that everyone checks out the site and certainly keeps an eye on their email for when that does go live. John, I want to thank you again. You know, we're very excited and think very highly of Pantera. So certainly want to thank you all on the team. And of course, for your time today.
No, it was such a pleasure, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from YieldStreet. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At YieldStreet, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to YieldStreet. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.